You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the meeting grounds for spirituality and society, religion and culture.
These are from the readings of Khalil Gibran.
This part of the meditation is selected from the writings of Khalil Gibran. The first one is on children. Your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but not from you. And though they are with you, yet they belong not to you. You may give them your love, but not your thoughts, for they have their own thoughts. You may house their bodies, but not their souls, for their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. You may strive to be like them, but seek not to make them like you. For life goes not backward, nor tarries with yesterday. You are the bows from which your children as living arrows are sent forth. The archer sees the mark upon the path of the infinite, and he bends you with his might, that his arrows may go swift and far. Let your bending in the archer's hand be for gladness. For even as he loves the arrow that flies, so he loves also the bow that is stable. The next one is on giving. You give but little when you give of your possessions. It is when you give of yourself that you truly give. On love. Love gives naught but itself, and takes naught but from itself. Love possesses not, nor would it be possessed, for love is sufficient unto love. On beauty, where shall you seek beauty, and how shall you find her, unless she herself be your way and your guide? And how shall you speak of her, except she be the weaver of your speech? On joy and sorrow, your joy is your sorrow unmasked, and the selfsame well from which your laughter rises was oftentimes filled with your tears. And how else can it be? The deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. When you are joyous, look deep into your heart, and you shall find it is only that which has given you sorrow that is giving you joy.
I'm fascinated by biography, and I've often enjoyed the experience of exploring other people's lives. And I found that over time, I'd made contact with the writings of Khalil Gibran. That's the correct pronunciation, by the way. It's with a soft G rather than a Gibran. It's the school teacher in me. But the alternative spelling is J-U-B-R-A-N. What a conflicted life he led. What beautiful things came out of his mouth. And how, in fact, like everybody, we're walking contradictions, aren't we? That there is that contradictory element, that tension within us, and I want to explore some of those, the beautiful things, as well as some of the contradictory things. He was born in Lebanon, a village in the north of Lebanon, which is a very beautiful spot. I'll show you a photograph or two later, in the village of Bishari, al-Bishari. And I've got a few photos of his house. It's kept as a museum by the Lebanese. He originated from a humble family. His father worked as a tax collector. His mother, Camilla, had one son from previous marriage, Boutros or Peter. So Khalil had an older brother. After Khalil came his mother. Camilla gave birth to two daughters. One was Mariana and the other was Sultana, the little one. So you can see it was quite obviously quite a comfortable home. It's quite a large room. It's set up as now a shrine to Gibran. And you can see that the photograph there is actually a copy of an original painting of Gibran. His early life in Lebanon, I'll just quickly go through that, by his own account, and from an early age, he was high-spirited. He loved going out in stormy weather and running around. He would tear his clothes off and just go berserk, like I feel like doing after some of the hot weather we've been having. He was a brooding, somewhat soulful child. And from his earliest years, he said he drew constantly. Painting was his first passion, even before writing. And, of course, he communed with nature. He was a real nature boy. His mother, Camilla, was the daughter of a Lebanese Catholic clergyman. She was a Maronite. The Christian religion in northern Lebanon is... It's a branch of the Catholic Church, the Maronite Church, quite influential in northern Lebanon today. The painting of her there is a pretty realistic portrait of what his mother would have looked like. Thin, graceful, melancholy, beautiful singing voice, devoutly religious, and when she reached marriageable age, she was given away to her cousin, Hannah Abdel al-Salam Rama. And like many Lebanese of his time, Hannah immigrated to Brazil to make his fortune, and he died there, leaving Camilla, a widow, with a son, Boutros, the older brother. Sometime after his death, the young Camilla remarried to Khalil Gibran Sr., giving birth to a son and two daughters, the poet Khalil Gibran and Mariana and Sultana. The father was an entirely different kettle of fish. His name was Khalil Gibran Saad Youssef Gibran. He owned a walnut grove in his village. He was one of the strongest men in Bishari. Basic education, temperamental, but with considerable charm. He had fair skin and amazingly blue eyes, which you will often find amongst the people in the Middle East, startlingly blue eyes. He was a very strong, sturdy man. He had a physicality about him that was hostile to his son's sensitive artistic nature. Khalil Sr. would have seen the younger Khalil as mummy's boy, I suppose. The family's meagre income was squandered in gambling and alcohol, so he had his addictions, and everyone feared him, including his wife and his kids. He worked as an assistant when he wasn't farming in Khalil's uncle's pharmacy until his gambling debts forced him to work as a tax enforcer for the local Ottoman administrator, and of course he could resort to strong-arm tactics if need be. So, a potentially violent situation. Despite those flaws, Gibran was able to express some positive feelings. He said about his father, it was his daring to be himself, his outspokenness, his refusal to yield that got him into trouble. If hundreds were about him, he could command them with a word. He could overpower any number of people by the expression of himself. So, we have the ingredients, the mother spiritual, the father temperamental, angry, striving for self-control perhaps. And we see these elements within the psyche of young Khalil, the asceticism and spirituality of a loving mother, the impulsive, outspoken volatility of an impetuous and addiction-prone father. There were other boyhood influences. One was a Muslim man who lived locally, Salim Dahir, who was a teacher and wise man. In another time, in a pre-literate society, he was so wise and so supporting of the community that he could easily have been written down as mythology, which had been added to in time, and we might even indeed have had another Jesus Christ, somebody to load up all the good images, all the positive things. He said of Salim, "But some people are so wonderful that I wonder whether their life isn't a creation after all. You remember Salim Dahir? He was a poet, a doctor, a painter, a teacher, yet he never would write or paint as an artist. But he lives in other lives. Everybody was different for knowing him. Al-Bashari was different. I'm different. Everybody loved him so much. I loved him very much, and he made me feel very free to talk to him." So Salim would have been a significant impact on the young Khalil. Also, it would be wise to include Jesus as the personal hero of Khalil Gibran. He identified with Jesus, the man, the same sort of Jesus that we identify with. Jesus, not as part of a Trinity, not created God because the church could see power and influence in making Jesus a God as part of a Trinity, but as the man he was. He always imagined him as man, not God, that the church had made him out to be. He had dreams about meeting him while out walking, and his creative imagination was filled by stories he had heard about Jesus' life and acts. A very important story was the setting for the Jesus' Beatitudes. He tried to imagine what it must have been like to be there in Jesus' presence as an eyewitness at the time. In a sense, he took on the persona of Jesus in his imagination without, I don't think he was delusional about it. His last and longest book in English was Jesus, the Son of Man, significantly, a Unitarian Jesus, not a Trinitarian one. When he was 12, the family split up. Camilla took the children and migrated to the United States, the land of opportunity, with her children, to seek a better life. The father was left saddled with his financial problems, and Camilla then became the breadwinner in America, settling in South Boston, in the south end of Boston, the poorest part of Boston. At this stage, Khalil had had no formal education, and he was placed in an ungraded class in Boston reserved for immigrant children who had to learn English from scratch. He caught the attention of his teachers with his sketches and drawings, a hobby he had started during his childhood. He had come under the influence of a photographer, Fred Holland Day, who somehow curiously fits into the story. And this is why we have so many rather marvellous portraits of the young Khalil. He took fascination, the photographer, this is in this case, he took a fascination in young Oriental boys, and he was known to photograph them nude, and there would be some serious concerns about this man having contact with young people today. But in those days, it seemed to pass unnoticed. There is absolutely no evidence of any sexual abuse or anything like that, other than Khalil's later depression, which I'll talk about. Anyway, Day opened lots of doors. He'd opened doors to the New York, to the Boston and later New York glitterati, the educated people. He opened the way, first of all, for Gibran to display his remarkable art. This went on in Boston until Khalil turned 15, and then he returns to Lebanon to concentrate on speaking Arabic and French. And he attended the Maronite College La Sagesse in Beirut, which you can see a photograph of here. These are more modern buildings, obviously, than when Khalil was there. But the school is still going strong, and it's obviously a very good school and very highly regarded. His teachers considered him quite a unique student. A kindly Arab teacher said he was a loving and controlled heart, an impetuous soul, a rebellious mind, the arrogance of a young 15-year-old, nothing unusual about that, sensing his talents, an eye mocking everything he sees. You've seen it in young people of similar age. They think they know it all. He lived with his father initially, but it was short-lived. He had to move out, the relationship became strained, and he moved in with a cousin who was a little more supportive. The first love came to the young Gibran in the form of Selma Karami. Khalil was 18. Selma had unhappily married a rather rakish young man who, in fact, she'd been given away to him. The local archbishop had prevailed upon the father of Selma to agree to this marriage. They were completely unsuited, but nevertheless she was locked into this marriage. There was nothing she could do about it. And of course Khalil was desperately in love with her, but it remained a platonic relationship. Unfortunately, just to conclude that story, she eventually, after 5 years of marriage, she bore her husband a son. The husband's name was Mansour, and unfortunately, she and the son died in childbirth. So Khalil, of course, was left absolutely heartbroken at this. And he returned to Boston in 1902. Another artist that I think we should look at, I don't know whether you're familiar with the art of William Blake, you might be more familiar with his poetry. You know, the tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night. What immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? He was a kindred spirit, although separated in time. They were both mystics in art and religion, and they both explored the spirituality of human nature. They were both critical of organized religion. Blake indeed criticised the Anglican Church. Traditional religions were criticised because of its upholding of the class structure, particularly where people who were locked into particular jobs like chimney sweeping couldn't ever leave. There was this rigidity of class that he was very critical of. Both were interested in exploring the gaps between all religions and to come to some sort of understanding of a universal spirituality. Both faced accusations of madness. They were both considered at various times of their lives to be mad. In fact, Khalil was later to say in his work on madness, he wrote a book called The Madman, "I have found both freedom and safety in my madness, the freedom of loneliness and the safety from being understood, for those who understand enslave something in us." You can see the artwork is very similar. Blake's is on the left and Gibran's on the right. I put together a little montage of both artists, you can see how similar they are. There was also Leonardo da Vinci. I can also remember being given a book of Leonardo da Vinci's sketchings. The image that I've got there with a young Khalil in the background is a modern recreation of the early self-portrait that da Vinci did of himself. But Khalil's line work and his artwork remind me very much of Leonardo. He writes that Leonardo prints were like a compass needle for a ship lost in the mists of the sea. They awakened his artistic sensibility and yearning to become an artist. When Gibran returned to Boston after La Sagesse, within 15 months of returning, he lost his family, with the exception of Mariana, through TB. the rest of the family got TB. First Peter and the mother and the little sister, Sultana. So Mariana, pictured here, was the only one left. She absolutely adored him. She took over where the mother left off. She cooked his dinners, made his clothes, and supported the two of them on the earnings of a dressmaker's shop. Gibran still took no art. Art was his job at the moment. At this moment, the commissions hadn't arrived. There was also Mary Haskell, who came along not long after the tragedy. She was part of the glitterati. She was well off. She came from a very wealthy family. They were introduced by the photographer, Fred Holland Day. And Gibran had a first art exhibition in 1904. And Mary, from a well-to-do family on the other side of town, had faith in him and made his start possible. What followed was a frustratingly complicated relationship. Mary was 7 years his senior and considerably taller. Gibran was only 5'3" in the old terms, or 160 centimetres if you've metricised. Khalil tried to conceal their relationship. He didn't want the relationship to be seen as a mistress and lover. There is some evidence that the relationship was largely platonic and she was briefly his lover, but remained from then on for the rest of his life a mother surrogate. She filled the gap left by Camilla and she became his lifelong patron and promoter. Haskell's conservative family would never have consented to her marrying an immigrant or someone like Khalil. There is, just backtracking to Mary again, they both believed that, and Khalil as well, both believed that a great destiny awaited her. She, I think, awakened his inclination towards narcissism. Going into the history, the critical elements, as well as the congratulatory, narcissism has always been part of Khalil's personality. I think it was awakened, first of all, by a doting Camilla and fostered even further by Mary Haskell. She recorded his premonitions and visions. For instance, she stated that he had intuitively discovered the theory of relativity before Einstein. He just hadn't written it down. Damn. So there were some wider influences at the time too. Madame Blavatsky was the rage in Boston. She was a spiritualist who started the theosophy movement. From 1908 to 1910, he went back to Paris and studied with Auguste Rodin. And in 1912, he moved from Boston to New York. Boston became a bit too small townish for him. And so he decided that it would be better if he moved to the big time and devote himself to writing and painting. There were other influences on Gibran, and certainly Christianity, as I've said, through the Maronites. There was Islam, there was Sufism, Hinduism, and Theosophy. And then there was the almost perennial image of Friedrich Nietzsche, of the God is dead fame. He styled a lot of his beliefs on this philosopher who was seen as a sort of a pop figure at the time, I guess. So that created no doubt a tension, a cognitive dissonance in his mind between the nihilism of Nietzsche and coming to terms with that in his own philosophy, which was inherently spiritual. Nietzsche is another person I one day would like to explore. And then there was the spiritual influence of Abdul Baha, the son of Baha'u'llah, the founder of the Baha'i faith. He saw in Abdul a noble form enough to be a receptacle for the Holy Spirit. And then we have the influence of other poets like Yeats, the sculptor Rodin, and the writer John Galsworthy, and the Swiss psychiatrist Carl Jung. Unfortunately, from that point on, Khalil tried to create a complete remaking of his image. From his poverty, he tried to reinvent himself in New York as of noble birth. He had come from a palace in Beshari, had kept tigers for pets. The parents were unimaginably wealthy, and he was educated at home by English, French, and German tutors. In moving to New York, he abandoned the two women he meant most to, and this was going to weigh very heavily upon him. His fame came with The Prophet, which we've had some reading of today, and the poems of The Prophet focus on such things as mundane things like children, marriage, work, houses, clothes, beauty, and death. The Prophet is given the name Al-Mustafa, the chosen and beloved one, a gentle teacher, and a lot of it is reminiscent of the Sermon on the Mount. Each lesson is simple, achievable, and tugs at the emotions. His popularity peaked in the 30s, and then the world forgot about him suddenly for another 30 years, and he re-emerged in the 60s. His fame being reawakened by people like John F. Kennedy, the Beatles, and Indira Gandhi, surprisingly. In the 60s, you had the phenomenon of religion as a consumer item. And so you find his sayings being in the form of easily remembered aphorisms appeared on T-shirts, and there was a reawakening of a cult mentality there. Mary, at this time, decided that it was time to marry, and she married a wealthy southern landowner in 1927 who'd made his money from real estate. But she nevertheless retained a close personal interest in his affairs, and she had to cope by this time Gibran's deep depression and alcoholism. And things were so bad there, and she had a marriage, so a new secretary was hired, Henrietta Beckenridge, who managed Gibran and managed his moods as well. So there were parallels in the demise of Blake and Gibran. They went suddenly out of fashion. The glitterati had moved on to new fads in poetry and art. So in retrospect, we have the dilemma of a man who drifted from fame into depression and alcohol that overtook his life and eventually killed him. We find Shakespeare also a person who had outstanding insights into life, and yet he had his flaws. The scrutiny of the 400th year anniversary has people researching in more detail the life of William Shakespeare. We don't stop reading Shakespeare because he failed as a human being in some way. We are all flawed, and perhaps both Khalil and William showed us that this is just a part of life. We have to run with our strengths, and also we're encumbered to a degree by our weaknesses. One of his great strengths, I think, and Brendan remarked on this earlier, I think, the fact that he recognised in many of the words that are spiritually significant words, words like fear and courage, insanity and madness, love, hate, joy, sorrow, pain, ecstasy, those words, strength, weakness, he recognised a spectral quality, that it's part of a continuum, that we know love through the hate, or through the lack of love. We know the joy through the sorrow, and one defines the other. We know the words by the company they keep, said John Firth, an English linguist. Any high achiever knows that success and the sacrifice it involves comes at a cost. And his alcoholism caused enlargement of the liver, cirrhosis, cancer and developing consumption. And he died in New York, aged only 48. His sister and Mary Haskell, assisted by Henrietta, his private secretary, remained devoted to him to the end and well beyond his death. We have the museum in North Lebanon, Al-Bashari, that was established after he died. This is an old monastery, an old Maronite monastery in northern Lebanon. What a beautiful place that is. Hey, what a sighting of a building into a cliff face. She donated to it the world's largest public collection of his art, and Mary can be congratulated on not being self-seeking in that. She gave it all away to institutions to remember the man. He bridged the gap between Christianity and Islam, and I guess the disregard of dogma earned him condemnation from both sides as a heretic. He was, to my mind, a universalist kindred spirit. He never, I don't think he knew anything about Unitarian Universalism, but he seems to epitomize that quality, the ability to explore the religious divide that so many of us are doing. Amen.
That's our episode of Expanding Horizons for the week. The introduction is a piece named Elements by the artist CDK. The piece is licensed under Creative Commons. This is White Rabbit, out.